Well, first, on behalf of HIMSA and the Institute for World Religions, I wish to thank all of you for coming and welcoming you here. This is the first of a six-part series on Living Insights, and it really grows out of a conference, or the enthusiasm for it grows out of a conference that we had last October, basically on the human capacity for peace. And in this series, we've invited speakers to reflect on aspects of their own traditions and insights and contemplations, meditations, etc., which in turn may add to our own insights and understanding. And so we have here an opportunity to deepen our knowledge and experience the diverse wisdom traditions and to enrich our own personal practices, both inwardly and in terms of work and compassionate social action. Our evenings will be a bit richer than indicated by the program, which may have been passed out. Some of you may have it. And that is, we are delighted that besides the speaker tonight being Joe Barbro, that we also have respondents, and this tonight is Doug Powers. And the feeling then is that more than just a moderator, the respondent shares some of the same tradition or backgrounds or complementary background, and so is invited, after the speaker has said yes now, to enjoy a dialogue with the speaker as it then broadens out, and as in this case Doug then broadens it out to all of us. So we have a second voice to further expand the dialogue and questions and thoughts across traditions and perspectives. Therefore, we invite all of you to take part in this discussion, and exactly how it unfolds, I leave to the speaker and the recipient. I needn't really comment on the state of the world. I think that's pretty obvious. But it does seem that in all cultures that I think of, if you've had peace, you've had some culturated values of peace. And values of peace mean you've had some culturated awareness. And in a way, then, is a wonderful way to start today, because we're looking at basically awareness through Buddhism and psychology. Joe Barbro is the founder and director of Deep Springs Institute in Zendo. And the Zen Roshi is also a licensed psychologist in a private practice in San Francisco and a faculty member and supervisory analyst at the Psychoanalytical Institute of Northern California. And he writes on Buddhism, psychotherapy, and their interplay. And Doug Powers has been a long-term student of Buddhism. He has a master's from the GTU. He teaches philosophy and Buddhism at the Dharma Realm University and is intimately connected here at the Buddhist Center. He also teaches and has taught for over 30 years at Berkeley High School, where he's known to introduce his students to Buddhist meditations and occasionally get them down the block here to come and visit and meditate here too. So Joe, when I asked him about if he could give some insight as to what he wanted to talk about, he simply said, this is almost a quote, "I'll let the theme of insight and its embodiment in the relational world chart this course." And so at this point, I'd like to hand over the wheel, or in this case, I guess, the Dharma Chakra wheel, to Joe. And I thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Can people hear me okay? I have one no.
I can turn it up a little bit.
Raise your hand if you cannot hear me. If you cannot hear me. Okay. Everybody can hear me. It's a real pleasure to be here with you tonight. If you're having difficulty at any point, just move up a little bit closer. Just come up a row or sit closer in. Zen is actually very intimate in that way. We, you know, in our Doksan room where teacher and student meet for private interview, we're literally nose to nose, you know. So don't feel bad about scooting up. I think tonight I'm not going to talk about Zen and psychology. I think inevitably psychology and our emotional life will creep into the talk. But I'm going to speak about Zen, and hopefully we'll have an experience of Zen tonight. For those of you who learn by taking notes, by all means, take notes. If you can do without taking notes, I really invite you to try it. Zen is very immediate, and it's a lot less in what the teacher talks about than in what quickens between the listener and the speaker. What is evoked? In Zen, we want to see if there's some spark that gets evoked. And that's why Nick chose his format of having a respondent. And we'll see what develops between us. Zen is a transmission beyond the scriptures. So I'm not going to be talking that much about Zen philosophy today. So for those of you who are expecting a very philosophical talk, you might be a little disappointed. Zen is that school of Buddhism which is probably the least philosophical, the least intellectual, although it's not anti-intellectual and it's not anti-philosophical, to the contrary. But the invitation in Zen is to put aside our discursive minds, put aside our problem-solving minds, decision-making minds, and just be. You know, Ram Dass called it be here now. The idea is that in being fully here now, the world will open up in a way we never could imagine. And we'll feel a depth and perhaps even a clarity that we couldn't have imagined existed in the present moment. Well, the present moment is boundless, immeasurable, and is our true treasure in Zen. So please listen with your ears, and of course you'll process with your discursive mind, which wants to figure things out and get an answer and get a blueprint, have something to take with you, some formula. But if you can, please also open to listening with your whole body. What would that be like, to listen with your all the cells in your body, as if I were speaking just to you, with an immediacy and an urgency, but without anxiety? The urgency in Zen is to understand the meaning of our living and dying, so that we can be liberated into each moment. What would that be like, to be liberated into each moment? So that each moment would be a reflection of the Absolute. Each moment, whether good, bad, or indifferent, would be presenting our true nature, what some people might call God, or the sacred, or the divine. There are many names for the divine, aren't there? More names than you can shake a stick at. But what if God were calling in each moment, but our phone was busy? Or maybe off the hook? So there is a method in Zen. The method is cultivating attentiveness. But the method doesn't exist as a fetish. It doesn't exist to be practiced perfectly for its own sake. It exists to help us shake off our busy minds, our discursive minds that are always connecting the dots and making theories about things, and so living life one step removed. What would it be like if each moment of our life was a manifestation of the divine? That is the tenet of Zen, that the universal, the absolute, the immeasurable, the timeless, the infinite, those are its qualities, infinity, timelessness, immeasurability, is presenting itself to us as our own activity, as our own moment-to-moment activity, as our own ordinary circumstances, but that we can't recognize it. We can't appreciate it. When I was young, I always used to wonder what was on the other channels. Well, maybe if I turned the channel, I'd get a better show. Human beings are a little bit like that, aren't we? If I could only go to another Dharma center or a different country or a different tradition, I'd find a better show. But, you know, what do they call it in the circus? The big top? And the big top is right here. We're in the midst of the jewel. Sometimes in Buddhism we talk about a jewel. But because of our own fetters, we can't recognize it. And so our lives tend to be driven helter-skelter, torn between being pulled toward things and pushing things away. In Buddhism, we call this attachment and aversion. And it's so hard to bear witness to the present moment. And this present moment doesn't exclude the past. It contains the past. It's big enough to contain the past and the future. Before we do a little meditating, I tell a little story. The first time I met Thich Nhat Hanh, who was one of my teachers, my main teacher was Robert Aitken Roshi, and his teacher, Yamada Koen Roshi, in the Soto tradition of Zen. And Robert Aitken and Thich Nhat Hanh, who was my teacher for a few years in the early 80s, shared the distinction of independently coining the phrase engaged Buddhism, independently of one another. So the Buddhism that I grew up with, the Zen that I cut my spiritual teeth on, was always an engaged Zen. No matter how many sesshin we did, no matter how much silent retreat, and we did a lot of it, I did a lot of it, many, many retreats, no matter how much quiet sitting, the upshot, the litmus test, is always in daily living. How do we live? Can we manifest in daily living the infinite, the timeless, the boundless, which brings with it certain qualities of being, kindness, courage, fearlessness, compassion, inclusiveness. When we shed our small, self-absorbed self and open to the boundless, practice living there. These qualities accrue from that practice. So the upshot was always engaged Buddhism. We didn't even need the term engaged. You're always engaged, whether you like it or not. And what are we engaged in? We're engaged in myriad relationships, myriad connections. Whether we like it or not, we're connected. I could describe how that's so, but I think we'll just take that as a given, that interconnection is so. So that the truth and the insights of Zen, insight into our true nature, must come forth and manifest in daily living. And if we're able to integrate our practice, it does. If our practice is disconnected from daily living, then we don't. And we have wonderful tricks that we do in our meditation, wonderful states we enter. But unfortunately, some of those don't translate into our daily life. On the other hand, of course, it's a great danger to get so caught up in daily living that there's no ability to reflect, there's no ability to be silent, there's no ability to examine closely what's going on. Because Zen is bearing witness to what is so. It's very simple. Attending to what is so. And in attending to what is so, more and more and more deeply, we come to see deeper and deeper and deeper dimensions of what is so. It can begin with something as simple as acknowledging that we're here together tonight. And for the moment, I'm the one talking, and you're the ones listening. I'm just acknowledging, here we are. Just beginning with what is so. So the first time I met Thich Nhat Hanh, it was in a monastic setting. And I'm assuming some of you may know who Thich Nhat Hanh is. He's a Vietnamese Zen teacher and poet, social activist. And it was in a monastic setting. It was his second time in the United States from Vietnam. And he was very highly thought of as a Vietnamese monk. And the monastics and the other lay Zen practitioners present were putting on their very best Zen postures. And it was kind of an uptight atmosphere. I don't sense that now, but I'm just describing this little story to you. We were all sitting there. And when he came in, everyone kind of got restless and waiting for him to say something. And I got a sense that the underlying, what was so, what was happening was, you know, sort of waiting for the words of the master and waiting on best behavior. In a kind of uptight way, if I might say. It was very uncomfortable. And there I was sitting, part of it. And Thich Nhat Hanh comes in, and he's smiling. And he sits, and he looks at everybody in the eyes. And people are fidgeting, and waiting for the words from the master. And he sits with a smile, he keeps looking at people. The more he's sitting and enjoying, the more restless and agitated everyone's becoming, and the harder they're trying not to appear restless and agitated. And then finally he says, "Does the silence bother you?" With his finger directly on the pulse of what was so in that moment. And of course, everyone said to themselves, why, of course not. I'm a meditator, or I'm a monk, or I'm a priest, or I'm a nun. You could almost hear them say it, although we didn't say it aloud. And then there was another probably 60 excruciating seconds of silence during which he was smiling this beatific smile. And then he said, please, enjoy your breathing. And it was such a wonderful teaching for me in that moment, coming from a Japanese Zen tradition which valued effort, you know, and discipline involved in focusing the mind, developing attention, concentration, and mindfulness, vows, and commitment, engagement. Such a wonderful teaching just to enjoy being alive, to enjoy the moment. This is 1983, and I've carried it with me for 22 years. Because it's a common conventional misunderstanding about Zen that we all have broomsticks up our rear ends, and that it's all about sort of punishing the body and seeing how disciplined we can be and how tough. But it's not like that. We don't purposefully discipline ourselves any harder than the practice requires. The practice of Zen has its own discipline. Because our minds are like horses, just chafing at the bit. Don't you know this? When you're trying to focus, or you're trying to settle, you're trying to let go, you're trying to be in the moment, we're pulled here and pushing away from there. We're like wild horses, or in the Buddhist metaphor, monkeys. We have a monkey mind. Usually, not always, usually we don't want to settle. We don't want to collect our minds and hearts and be here now. It can bring up a lot of anxiety. So the practice of attentiveness in the moment is a rigorous practice. We don't need to suffer anything additional to what life gives us. So I want to dispel that notion of Zen that it's particularly masochistic or sadistic or severe. Just the practice of awareness has its own discipline. It's a wonderful discipline. And sometimes it's a rough discipline to have the patience, the forbearance to sit through difficult patches, to be able to bear witness not only to the pleasurable and the blissful and the relaxing, but that which is painful or confusing or unknown or disturbing that emerges either within us or between us or amongst us or in our city, nations, or the world. So can we develop the ability to remain conscious and awake through the good, the bad, and the ugly? If there is, the great jewel will reveal itself to us in every moment. That's the invitation of Zen. So all those qualities, all those difficulties, all the difficult patches, they come by themselves. We don't have to punish the body. We have to whip ourselves. It's not like that. Yeah, in Zendos, the cushions are black, and usually we wear dark colors, and there's a certain restraint and, a certain restraint and yet immersion in the moment. But it's not unpleasurable. There's great pleasure in surrendering to the moment, in being fully alive in the moment, in knowing that we have the wherewithal inside to meet the moment no matter what it presents. Isn't that a wonderful feeling, that sort of quiet confidence that we develop through Buddhist practice, but also in other ways, other practices help develop, the sort of quiet confidence that we can meet anything, that nothing will knock me off, completely break me. This develops with decades and decades of practice. The ability to roll with the punches. And life is always throwing curveballs, isn't it? I mean, always, intrinsic in life. The Buddha discovered sickness, old age, and death, and the monastic path. But sickness, old age, and death are not the only things that life throws our way. So Zen practice helps us develop these qualities of patience and inner strength, a kind of fearlessness. Which doesn't mean we don't feel anxious, it's just that we don't feel very anxious about being anxious, if you follow what I'm saying. It's not that we don't feel fear, but we don't really feel paralyzed by fear about being afraid. It's just part of life. That's a great gift. These are all qualities that develop with Zen practice. The one I want to make the most of right now as we go into some meditation is the pleasure, the true enjoyment that comes from simply being alive with nothing added, with nowhere to go, nothing to do, no one evaluating, including myself, if I'm failing or succeeding, or how am I doing now, or looking good, or any of that. It's sort of an exercise that we can't fail. Isn't that marvelous? We just enter into it and just are. So although, of course, this freedom to enjoy life and to weather its storms with serenity, which brings its own joy, develops over many decades, a whole lifetime of practice. And yet at the same time, it's sort of nice to have a pinch of it when we begin. And all of us have had moments where we taste this kind of freedom to enjoy simply being alive in our bodies, attentive, with no particular place to go, as the song, didn't Elvis sing that, no particular place to go? I think he did. I forgot what song it was. So it's in that spirit that why don't we do a few minutes of meditation? And let yourself find a posture which suits you, which isn't rigid, but which is keeping your back and your neck, those are the two fulcrums, as straight as you can without stiffening up. If you'd like to sit on the floor with a cushion, there are cushions in the back. If you're more comfortable doing that, that's fine. Take a pad or two. These pads are a little thin, so you might need a couple of the pads, and a cushion or two. And just find that position that suits you best and where you can find a little S-curve in the lower part of your back, so your back can support your torso. It's the heaviest part of the body. And then allow your neck to straighten a little bit without, you know, coming to attention. But allow your neck to straighten a bit, and it will help hold up our head, which is not the heaviest part of our body, but often feels like the heaviest part of our body because it's so full. So the neck and the lower back as straight as possible, and you can put your hands in your lap, fold them, put them on your thighs, whatever suits you. In Zen, we use this little mudra, sort of half circle. But you can use whatever, place your hands however you wish. Some people close their eyes, some people keep them half open. Probably better to do either that, keep them half open and unfocused or closed. And once you've gotten settled in this posture, just feel the weight of your body on your cushion or on the floor. Really let yourself inhabit this body in this place, this time. Let yourself feel the force of gravity. We're collecting ourselves and letting ourselves settle. You may notice that there's quite a bit of goings on in your head, a lot of energy. Just allow that to settle into your belly. And just let your stomach and your belly be soft and supple and just hang. Be like one of those big old Buddhas. And see if you can notice that each time you breathe in, your belly rises. And each time you breathe out, your belly falls slightly. for whatever's going on in your body or your mind, just honor it, recognize it. Let it move to one side. Allow your attention to settle in your belly, deeply aware of the rising and the falling of the breath. Letting everything else melt away. Let yourself enjoy your breathing and the simple feeling of being alive in your body. You notice thoughts or tension in your body, simply take note and let your attention return to your belly, to the simple experience of being alive here in your body now. When you're ready, you can move a hand or a foot or just rock a bit side to side, and gradually open your eyes. Aware of whatever you're experiencing. And allowing that simply to be. And as you open your eyes and take in the visual surround, and we see one another and this marvelous temple, let yourself carry with you this hopefully refreshing experience. Do things look different? Do they feel different? Does your relationship with what you're seeing and hearing seem like it shifted in any way? Just something to wonder about. Having dinner with a couple of people last week, and one couple was interested in Zen, and the woman asked me, "How do you teach Zen?" So I said, "Do you want the long intellectual version, or do you want the simple, true version?" She said, "Well, why don't you give me the simple version?" So I poured some water and I took a sip of the water. I put it down, waited a couple of seconds, and she said, "Basically, I'm still waiting. If you've shared anything, it's gone completely over my head." And I said, "I'm sorry for that." But she chose which one she wanted, and I gave her the one she wanted. But life is like that. In the simplest moments of life, everything is full and complete. But it passes over our heads. The sound of the bell takes us to our true home. The sound of the bell presents our true home to us. Now, some of us may say, "Well, what he means is the bell really helps me relax because it's so beautiful." It is, isn't it? If we really listen to the bell and enter the sound of the bell, it's very beautiful. We can lose ourselves. Maybe for just a minute, and all of a sudden there's just that sound of the bell, and it's ringing right through us. Have you ever had that experience with something, with some event? Usually in the natural world, you know, maybe you're in front of a beautiful sight or on top of some cliffs, or maybe a peak moment with someone you love, maybe the birth of your child or the death of a loved one, or some very intense emotional experience. But be it in nature, or at the movies, or in front of a piece of art, or in deep religious contemplation, the experience is the same. There's an experience of shedding what in Zen we call the small self. Not by will, not by saying, stop bothering me, or stop having those desires, or stop thinking about your own needs. It's not like that. But just by virtue of patient awareness, insightful awareness of how that small self constellates, and gradually releasing from the bondage of self-absorption and self-centeredness. I don't know if any of you have seen the movie What the Bleep Do We Know Anyway? Any of you seen that movie? It's a wonderful movie, especially the first half. I really loved the first part of that movie. I thought it's some jerky movie, you know, some cartoon. I didn't know what it was until I picked it up, and it was probably good that I didn't know what it was. But in the first part, they talk about quantum physics and the quantum physics view of the universe. And I couldn't believe this one sentence. And the one sentence that this one scientist said was, actually, the true nature of this moment is that there's absolutely nothing permanent and nothing substantive at all. This moment is completely spacious and empty of anything we can even call a thing. Now, we know that in terms of, you know, the difference, for example, between a wave and a particle. You know, it just depends on how you look at it, if you're going to see a wave or a particle. And also, when you look at particles, you don't really see particles, you see the probability that they might be there. So the fundamental nature of the universe is very vast. There's no things we can really identify. Now, we take form to be a thing, don't we? I look at Henry, and there's Henry. He's there. But if we really deconstruct it, I'm constructing Henry in every moment. I'm connecting the dots using my marvelous nervous system to construct Henry. So this is a marvelous revelation that either through quantum physics or through Zen, we take as axiomatic, and through practice we discover that there's nothing at all. Nothing at all. And matter doesn't constrain us whatsoever. Matter is light happening to fall down in a certain way, and we take in that light and connect the dots up and recognize, oh, there's a woman. But that's not fixed in any way. It's completely free. Now, this is a marvelous thing to hear, because something dawned on me. What dawned on me, I made a new connection. I love new connections. What dawned on me was, this gives us great freedom. We're always wondering in this life, you know, philosophically, how free are we and how conditioned are we? But if we really experience, and if we don't experience, maybe we just have faith for a moment, that this palette is completely vast and wide, has no objects in it. None whatsoever. But it's how we connect the dots and how we respond to the raw materials that we're really bringing form into being by our own perception of it. Now, I don't mean we create our own reality, and if I want to create a marvelous reality, why, I'll just do it here and we'll end war immediately. It's not that easy. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that what many people take as the end point of Zen, which is sometimes, you know, emptiness, or in Sanskrit we use the word shunyata. It means the shining void. It's really a very fertile place. It's a place of potential space and spaciousness, where the seeds and the potential of all things lie. But there are no objects in it. There's no things. It's also the source of the artist's creativity. That's how artists talk. You know, they just sort of hang out in an open space and something emerges. That's how creativity happens. Well, what if this was actually the way things actually are? And we're creating the objects we see and interact with. Why I found that really intriguing was that it's our response to being alive that shapes our own reality. You see? If I construct Henry as a mean old son of a bitch, excuse my French, then Henry's going to be, you know, a mean old son of a bitch. And he can be pretty crotchety. I mean, he's, you know, oppositional, and he's always combative. He takes the opposite point of view. I happen to like it. Most people find him very endearing, actually. But I could also connect the dots in Henry as a mean son of a bitch. I could. And usually I do that by virtue of my own conditioning, isn't it? I put something there in Henry that sees something bad. Now, it's not to say that certain people don't have certain qualities. We're not completely naive. If someone's really mad or if they're unscrupulous, hopefully if we practice Zen and practice attentiveness, we're going to pick up on that. But what I'm saying is, Zen is about fundamental meaning of life. If I want to go to the bottom, if I want to take the express, I don't mean, you know, sort of fast foods, but if in this life, if I want to really understand the meaning of living and dying, go to the heart of things, that means that if I look at somebody, I want to see them as they truly are. Now, what does that mean, to see someone as they truly are? If I meet someone for the first time, I'm aware of what kind of emotional feeling we constellate together. It might feel really great. It might feel kind of anxious. It might feel kind of, I don't know. It could feel 1,000 different ways. I'm aware a lot of different levels. Something happens between us. Whenever you meet someone, this happens. One psychoanalyst said, when you meet someone, there's an emotional storm, and you constellate a certain emotional space together. And it's different with each person. And it's different from moment to moment. It changes, it shifts. But is that who that person is? The emotional space that gets created between you, or the feeling that you have in that other person's presence, is that who they are? Who are they? It's the same question you ask when we ask, who am I? Or what's the nature of my life and death? If we really want to get to the bottom of things, it's like peeling an onion. Yeah, we're aware we have a certain feeling with someone. We're aware they have certain qualities. They're dressed a certain way. Immediately we know if they're in this class or that class. We can know so much about somebody, but do we really know them? Do we really, really know them? They may tell us their story. Story of woe and joy, just like we all have. Story of trauma and battling through adversity and making something of our lives. That's all of our story. And we hear the particular versions that we tell. And sometimes they're very, very inspiring. I met with a group of people, sort of intentional group meeting over the weekend, and it began very quickly with someone asking about the sculpture in the house. The sculpture happened to be a representation of someone's father, and he'd never met his father, but what he thought his father would look like. And then someone else started talking about their father, and I talked about my father. We all had father stories. We had this great sharing about our sort of father wounds and hungers and issues, and it was just wonderful. Very, very close and very, very deep. Is that who we are? Our stories of our traumas and our wounds, our battling through adversity. That's a large part of it. I mean, if we can connect on that level, then we really feel close to somebody, don't we? And I think we do. But is that who we are? Is that who we really are? Is that representation that we gave to one another? If we're really interested, keeping going, keeping penetrating, Ramana Maharshi used to do this. You know, who am I? Ramana Maharshi, great Hindu sage, Vedanta sage. And for him, it was a matter of takeaway. You know, he had a list of takeaways. I am not this. I am not that. I am not this. I am not that. Who am I? This is wonderful. He had nothing to do with Zen, but he's a wonderful teacher. As a Zen practitioner, I love people from any tradition who help us discover who we are in this life, and then to embody that as much as we can in our day-to-day dealings. So who is this person in front of me? I could give you the answer, but it's not about having a crib sheet and getting the answer. It's about discovering it for ourselves. But since time is limited, I'll give you one response. And that wherever we look, whoever we look at, we see a representation of that which can't be named, that which is immeasurable, of the Absolute itself. A particular refraction of the Absolute in form. A woman, an older person, a younger person, a Buddhist, a Zenist, a Hindu, an interfaith minister, a good man, a bad man who does bad things, hurts people. Is he no less a refraction of the divine light? That's my question. So what do we discover? What is our insight when we go to the heart of things in Zen? This is about insight, right, and engagement. What is the perennial insight in Zen? Well, I can tell you about it, and you can taste it to some degree in each moment. But of course, Zen is also a path of training and practice. And people practice their whole lives and are always going deeper, always refining their insight, always refining the expression of that insight in their daily lives, always honing spiritual qualities, learning more about how they're out of accord with the Absolute and its spiritual qualities, and learning from that. But let me share didactically a little bit about the insight. The insight is that the universal and the particular, right, the absolute and the phenomenal, co-arise. And they co-arise in each moment of living. Would that we be open to that. And would that we understand that in our heart of hearts. How would our life be different if we understood that sitting in front of me was a representation in the realm of the particular, in the realm of karma, of dharma, or the absolute. What if the joke about the car killed my dogma? You know, and the car ran by. What if our practice completely demolished our dogma, and we could see the divine in the person in front of us? How would that change the way we comport ourselves? What if we understood that in our heart of hearts, that every moment of living is nothing but the expression of the divine? I'm calling it the divine, but please don't get me wrong. My Zen friends are going to make me wash my mouth out with soap. But I just want to find some common language. You know, in Zen, we don't have any God, we don't have any divine, we don't have any of that stuff. But I'm just mixing up words here. But you get my point. How is that which knows no measure and takes no form, how is it that it comes forth in human forms, in animal forms, in animal minerals and vegetables, every moment. That's the paradox of Zen. That's the heart of all of those conundrum koans. You know, let Mount Tamalpais take three steps. That's one of the koans we work on. Or how would you express Buddha nature while taking a bath? That's a good koan. You see, if we completely understand that the universal and the particular have never been divided from the beginning, then we can respond to that koan. How does the Buddha nature manifest when you're taking a bath? Anyone want to have a go at that? I think a little kid could respond to that very easily. Very easily. See, these koans are not meant to trick us or stump us. They're meant to help us realize our true nature in the moments of daily living. I mean, what would it be like if cooking is the one activity you can't stand, and your wife or husband, whoever does the cooking, there are a lot of husbands who do the cooking. I'm meeting more and more. Wives just don't like to cook, or is a more on-the-go type of person. A husband, very nourishing, like to make nice soups and stuff. What if cooking or cleaning or whatever you hate to do, or listening to someone, you know, who really gets on your nerves, what if the things you hate the most, you really realize that those were Dharma gates? Those were gates you could use to realize your true nature. How would life be different? I think it might be a little different. It wouldn't make those activities or some of the people you have to deal with or the situation, it's not going to wash them clean and, you know, everyone's going to be just fine. Oh, everything's fine. No, it's not fine. It'll still have their qualities. And some people will be annoying, and some situations will be maddening. I mean, the condition of our world is maddening. How could it not be? Anybody whose heart and mind and eyes and ears are even a little open has to kind of be completely flummoxed and saddened by the state of our world and some of the efforts that are being made supposedly to make things better, make things a lot worse. So it's not that we don't encounter life as it is. It's just that life as it is doesn't break us down anymore, because we understand that every part of life is nothing but the manifestation of our true nature. See, what if we got that in our bones, in our heart of hearts? Then when we get sick, it's an inconvenience. That's not the end of the world. If the world's going to hell in a handbasket, we may be less paralyzed by helplessness. And maybe we're free enough to recognize our deep caring for the world, our sadness for the world, to grieve for the world, and to use the energy that's freed up to do what we can, to contribute as we can. Because we know that in this moment, in this corner of the world, is the whole universe. You understand? This has really wide ramifications, this insight. You know, we say, think globally, act locally. But what does that mean? What if the whole universe was local? So that in my interaction with you, I can make peace. That's really true. It's not a substitute for other forms of action. I'm a social activist. I like to shake things up, get things done. But you know, the bane of social activists is they get burnt out. They're always things, oh, there's more to do. You can never have time to do enough. You always feel like you're not. Well, what if just what you did was enough? And not enough as well, but enough. What if in your corner of the world you were saving the universe, saving all beings, as we say in Zen? There might be some quizzical looks. But this is where the rubber meets the road. We have epistemological blind spots. When I talk like this, you don't believe me. I know most of you don't believe me. You say, oh yeah, that's just self-serving. I stay in my nice little relationship and I treat my dog and my wife and my nuclear family really well, and the world's gone to hell in a handbasket, and what are you doing about that, Buddhist you? And I want to dismantle your epistemology, you see? That's what Zen does. It just shakes it all up. It says, where is that universe? It's right here. Each step to peace is peace itself. If you think Thich Nhat Hanh said that, you're wrong. A.J. Mustey said that, of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, Christian activist. Knew nothing about Buddhism, I imagine. Every step to peace is peace itself. That's the great teaching of Zen. Don't worry about what you're not accomplishing. Don't worry if you fail. Don't worry if you're good, or good enough, or better, or not as good as. Just embrace each moment with all of your heart. And you'll find the whole universe there. Thank you. Please sit any way you like. That mic is on, I think. Could someone make sure that this mic is live, or a mic is live?
Thank you. Let me, I'm going to slightly change the focus a little bit in my conversation with you.
Sure.
How do you, I think you've given us a really good expression of practice and Zen practice and sort of some of your insights into what that's about. But in your other role, which is still, I'm sure, not separate role, but in either working with people professionally or even with friends, even with other people, how do you make a distinction between where they need to be led to a deconstruction and where they need to be constructed enough to function? Where do you make that, how do you make that kind of, I know it's going to have something to do with your insight, I'm sure, from your sort of intuition from your meditation, but can you give us a little insight into how you feel that or see that?
That's a really nice way of putting it. It's a really nice way of putting it. Oh, it's always the emotional and psychological realities. I thought I could leave work and really leave work, but you're dragging me back.
We won't let you do that.
Okay. Let's start with, I'll go about a little bit roundabout way.
You don't need to do it through work. You could do it through your loved ones. You know, your.
Oh no, absolutely, yeah. No, absolutely. It's yeah. I think I got your point. I'll begin with something that's become axiomatic for me. I just take it as a given. That emotional development and psychological growth, personal growth, helps us embody spiritual insights and qualities. I take that as a given. Some people don't agree with that, but I do. I think psychological work, whether, as you said, it's between you and a friend, you and a loved one, you and your pet. It doesn't matter to me. You and your papaya grove. Life is relational. And when we touch what in Buddhism is called shunyata, or emptiness, we actually find a panoply of connections. We don't find a void. We find connection at the deepest level. Now, how do we work with all of those many connections as they manifest in daily living? That's where psychology comes in. Robert J. Lifton, you've heard of him? He studied, among other things, a remarkable man. Among other things, he studied the Nazi torturers. And he came up with this idea of doubling. I hope I can bring this one back, because once I let out the rope, sometimes I can't bring it back. But you'll help me bring it back. And what he discovered about Nazi torturers was that they were really good people in 95% of their lives. And this other 5% of their lives, they tortured people. And he called that the capacity for doubling, for almost compartmentalizing the self. So that you really treat most of your intimates really, really well, but then you do this other thing. I'm laughing at it because it's really dreadful, but it was true. And now I'm not saying that we're torturers, but all of us have a capacity for compartmentalization. Now, I see it in my own Zen teacher. I see it in my own self. I mean, my son, for example, when he was younger, living at home, he would say, I remember I had my ceremony as a Zen master, and all the final transmission was a big ceremony, and became a Roshi and all of this stuff. And it was wonderful. I had all my friends there and some students, and he was there. And then afterward, he said, "Hey, Zen master this. You can't even master my laundry." And what he was saying was that sometimes, you know, I didn't do his laundry mindfully, and I wasn't mindful to him. And I noticed this about my own teacher, you know, that he, in the Dokusan room with a student, I mean, he's like a tiger, like a dragon. You know, he's so there. He sort of gets it at so many levels, sort of helps you within the confines of the temple, within the confines of his Roshi-like duties. He's remarkable. And if you take him out of that context, he's sort of context-bound. You know, it doesn't always translate. So I've always been one to be interested in integration. How do we bring all these insights and the relational qualities, the spiritual, emotional qualities that just flow like a river when we're in the temple, how do we bring them to our dealings with our wives and husbands and partners and lovers and pets and students and all those other people? And I've been, my path has been informed by a lot of the scandals, you know, in Zen and Buddhism and other religions, and even close colleagues of mine who, you know, great insight, great teachers, great practice, great writers, and, you know, they treat people really badly and exploit people and deny that they even do it. So this contradiction has been alive for me for a long time, so I've always been interested in sort of bringing these two together and finding where they meet. So what I like to do, and what I think is the real contribution that I bring as a psychodynamic therapist — psychodynamic means to me that I'm aware of the unconscious impacts that human beings have, not just the conscious ones. So that within Buddhism, within spirituality, we have all these wonderful things like nonviolent communication. Have you heard about that? It's just remarkable. Of course, there was some version of that 30 years ago, but that's fine that it's had a resurgence. And we use conscious techniques to treat each other better, to listen to one another, to respond from a better place. But I'm personally less interested in the conscious techniques than in what happens between people unconsciously. Because my colleague, and O.J. Simpson too, really does believe that he didn't kill, you know, his wife. I'm sure he believes that. He and probably two other people in the universe believe that. And so does my colleague believe that he didn't exploit anybody. He denies it to this day. So it's not just consciously, you know, can we practice nonviolent communication, listening to one another? That's great. But I am very interested in my work and also in my interactions to be intuitively aware of what's getting constructed between two people in that emotional space between us. See? That emotional storm that happens, and there's a certain emotional field that gets created. We're not always aware of it. Now, sometimes it's not totally invisible. Have you ever seen some of the mother-infant development films where they videotape it, or they actually film it on a camera, which is even better, and they slow it down? You can see this remarkable dance between the mother and the infant, how they really are cueing off of one another, so that some of the interaction is actually visible. You just have to slow it down. Paul Ekman, a very famous researcher on emotions, has discovered, first of all, he's cataloged all the human emotions. He's at UCSF. He's actually retired. I'm going to do a program with him in March, if anyone's interested, on emotions and Buddhism. He's like the world expert on emotions. And he went to New Guinea and other places, and he tried to prove if Darwin was right when he said that emotions and their expressions are universal to all cultures, or if the culturalists were right and said emotions were different based on which culture you were in. Well, he found that emotions were universal across cultures. And he identified every human emotion. Can you imagine this? Every human emotion. And he forced himself, with he and his daughter and his colleagues, to make his face as pliable as possible, and he made every human emotion visually, and he cataloged them all and all the different variations of them. It's an amazing service. And he found that there are certain basic emotions that exist across cultures, across religions, across races, but it's the interpretation of the emotions which is different according to the cultures, and then the behaviors that ensue based on how you read certain emotions and their meaning in the social hierarchy and ladder and so on. But the emotions themselves, exactly the same. So that a Japanese person could recognize shame, and an African person could recognize anger and grief and mirth and glee and all these universal emotions. But what he then discovered is that there are certain things called micro-emotions. Now these, we can only see some of the time, and some of us are more cued into it than others, but with training, we can see them. Micro-emotions emerge in 16th of a second bursts. And again, you need to slow down the film to see them. So he shows films, and then you're looking and someone seems like they're really happy. And then he slows the film down just a little bit, not as slow as the infant researchers slow them down, just a tad. So it looks like it's almost full speed, but it's actually not. And you see happy, 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 disgust, happy, 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 happy. You got to see it to believe it. They're absolutely astonishing. Or you're having a conversation and you feel they're not really listening to you, but they look like they're listening to you. They say they're listening to you. Then you break down the film just a little bit. Listening, 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 contempt. And then listening, 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 listening. And then, so some of what I'm calling unconscious is actually visible. It's just beneath the threshold of our perceptual abilities. It's like certain sounds dogs can hear, but we can't hear it. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't know it's happening. We know everything. Our brains are very, very acutely attuned. There are parts of our brains which are attuned to the relational interaction. And we know something's amiss, even if we can't pinpoint it. So that's why as a teacher, I like to really listen to my students if they say, look, something feels uncomfortable between us. I want to hear about that before we do something, you know, that's not good, before we go our separate ways or get into anger or act something out. I trust those cues. You know, something feels uncomfortable. So as a teacher, I really listen to that. Now, I listened to my son for most of his 20 years. There were a couple of years in there where I didn't listen a lot. But I think because what I was listening to, I didn't really like a lot, and I thought was unfair. But mostly I try to listen to my son, and I try to listen to my intimates. And I try to include all those je ne sais quoi kinds of things that people will bring up. Things don't feel quite right, or you look kind of tired today, or what's up with you? Or you know, I take all of those really seriously. I try never to say, often I do think, but I never try not to say, oh, that's just your projection. You know, people say, well, as a teacher, you must get a lot of projection. Well, I do. And as a therapist, I get even more. And we work with all of those, and we try to learn from those. But the biggest danger is in reducing everything to projection. Oh, you're just laying your crap on me. That's the beginning of the end. So I try to, if I do anything, I try to take things seriously and give room and space to talk things out. If someone says to me, as someone said today, you know, don't give up on me. You're not, you know, throwing me overboard, are you? I mean, I take that really seriously. I'm going to want to talk with that person about it. So even a little joke, I take seriously. And we need to take all of these cues seriously because our intuitions are very acute. It's just that we don't have the wherewithal to process all the information. So I think this is very important practice for me. Number one, because I have some talents in this area. For better and for worse, I pick up on a lot of what people call vibes and all of this, which in neurobiology research is being debunked. It's not vibes. It's all perceptions that we're having with certain parts of our brain. But, you know, I just call it resonance or vibes or what, you know, vibrational level are we kind of zoning in on or what pattern is getting constellated between us. All those inarticulate things I take very seriously in the relational field because we can never become aware of all of it, nor should we ever want to, because there's always a little bit of mystery. There's always the unknown. But I think it really helps with compartmentalization, which I think is a really big problem. I mean, what if I'm teaching or preaching to my son or trying to embody non-judgmental awareness and unconditional love and all those other good things, and what the other person on the other end of it is picking up on is X, Y, Z, and A, B, C, expletive deleted, you know? We gotta be able to walk the talk is what I'm trying to say. And that's why, you know, your question is so right on. Now there was another part of your question which I want to allow for everyone to ask questions, for you to ask more questions, but you said something about when do you get a sense that somebody, let's just say a patient now, or it could be a Zen student or a friend, is suffering from a not enough or a deficit, and when do they need to sort of be, you know, experience more of a deconstruction? So I mean, that's interesting because psychologists, particularly psychoanalytic psychologists, used to think that most of our problems were caused by conflict. That's to say, conflict between people and conflict within people. And the way that they parsed it out was that we have an id, we have an ego, we have a superego. The id is the steaming cauldron of prohibited impulses and desires. The ego rides herd on, you know, between the id and the superego, which is the prohibitions of the culture, moral rectitude, internalized parental voices, religious internalizations, you know, thou shalt nots. And the ego kind of was the bridge between them that gave us enough pleasure, but hopefully you did it in good ways, so it didn't create a lot of grief. Now there's some wisdom to that, and there's sort of an interesting vision. It's come to be gradually abandoned, actually, as very limited. But for the moment, we'll use it. And so life is the perpetual conflict between, you know, our urges and our desires, which are kind of boundless, right? You know, we see someone we like, we just want to be with them. We want to talk with them. We want to, you know, do whatever we want to do with them, whatever, you know. Or we see a situation, we want it our way. You know, we want what we want, when we want, how we want it. That's supposedly the id. It's unbridled desire. And thank God for the superego and morals and ethics. And of course, Buddhism is full of ethics, you know, Shila, you know, the moral precepts and all of that. And the ego is equilibrating the two. So ego functions are very important. But one of the things researchers discovered was something called deficit. That some of us were not suffering so much from conflict. That's to say, we had a desire to kill our sister because she took our cherished place in the family pantheon. It wasn't that. We never got to the point where we could see our sister as a separate individual. We didn't even have that capacity. Everything was sort of one big salad. So that was what was called a developmental deficit. And so often when you sit with people, you sit and you just allow certain capacities to grow. That's to say, you don't interpret very much, you're not that active, you just kind of sit and listen to them. And gradually they come to feel that somebody cares about them, that you care about them, and that you kind of understand them. And what they take out of that is they take the image of me sitting with someone who really cares about me, and I am really important, I really matter in the world. They internalize that, and that becomes part of their internal structure. So where there was a deficit, there is now something they can draw on. They have had an experience over time. Somebody cares about me, I'm important enough to listen to, and they really do, most of the time, not all the time, understand me. Isn't that a marvelous thing to have inside as a resource? I mean, most of us don't have that on a regular, you know, reliable basis. I mean, most of us don't. Some of us do more than others, most of the time. But life events can snatch that away from us right away. So these capacities we develop. Now, how do I know when someone is suffering more from a deficit rather than sort of being all full of themselves and high and mighty and they need to sort of watch themselves in action a little bit and sort of deconstruct a little bit? That comes from experience and intuition, and it comes from a whole theory about psychologically how suffering develops. So I'll say a little bit about it since you asked it. I mean, my idea is that if we've had good enough what I call othering, not just mothering, but fathering, if we've had good enough othering, we've developed well enough. And so we haven't been too traumatized, and the traumas we've had have been of the average expectable garden variety traumas, and we've had the wherewithal to cope with those traumas. And we've made it through. With a few dings, but we've made it through. But that's not most of our story. Most of our story is that the traumas we've experienced have been very great indeed, and they haven't just happened once. They've happened several times. So we all of us have deficits. We all of us have lacunae. And what we do to compensate is we sort of pump ourselves up and we fill in the blanks. And how we fill in the blanks is, let's just summarize, by a kind of narcissism and self-centeredness. I am somebody who I'm not really. If you follow, I'm simplifying a whole lot. So then the process of therapy is actually helping someone feel safe enough that they can realize how they're pumping themselves up, begin to own some of those operations, and then experience some of that, those holes, some of those deficits, but in a new way, with someone who doesn't do the same thing to them that was done before. So they get to experience the painful moments and the holes inside in a reparative way. And that helps them grow through it and be more themselves and trust themselves more, so they don't have to put on airs. It's really a summary, but if you want to know in a nutshell my psychological theory, that's it. And so I'll just stop there and make more room for dialogue.
What time are we supposed to conclude?
9:30.
Okay, so why don't I, rather than asking another question right now, why don't I open it up to see if anybody else has a question? I have a lot of questions I could ask, but let me... Does anybody have a question they'd like to ask?
I would hope so. Comments, questions, personal experiences?
No, I have one question. You may have actually answered it as I was coming out, so I may have missed. But I always have the question about how one works toward, if you want to call it, healthy spirituality.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
I had a Zen Roshi friend who talked about somebody who other people said he has no ego. He said he has a very big ego,
yeah,
because he thinks he has no ego, and therefore he has to become well enough to recognize ego to overcome it. So the issue is, where does one really move toward a healthy spirituality? Does that define spirituality?
Wonderful.
And is that a way of, you know, how does that become acculturated?
Well, the first way to do that, Nick, is to dismantle our mistaken notions about ego. That's the first thing. Those notions sponsor unhealthy spirituality, period. I take umbrage at the word ego because for me, as a psychoanalytic therapist, ego is a set of functions that are critical to being human. What are those functions and capacities? The ability to identify emotion, to tolerate emotion, a wide range of emotion, to modulate and balance our emotions so, you know, it doesn't get too high and too low. This is called affect regulation. It's a critical function. If we can't regulate our emotional life, we're in deep, deep doo-doo. You know, emotional storm comes along and we fall apart. Now, all of us fall apart sometimes, but hopefully we learn to bend a little bit in the wind rather than break. So affect regulation, emotional modulation of emotions, is one of the ego functions. Memory is one of the ego functions. What would it be like if I walked out and I couldn't find my car? Well, it would probably be like every evening after I leave my office, but that's a different story. But what if I really could never find my car, or I didn't know that I brought my car? I'd be in deep trouble. I'd be taking the bus home and they'd end up towing my car away. What if I forgot to wash my face? You know, all of these things, judgment, perception, regulation. How about regulating anxiety? What if I couldn't regulate anxiety? I'd be in some deep problems. So ego functions are critical. Now, what are a couple of examples of unhealthy spirituality that flow from misunderstanding about this? Well, people come into the office and, I'll give you a little one. There are much bigger ones, like people flogging themselves to get rid of sexual desire. That's not a very healthy spirituality in my eyes. I mean, you may not choose to act on certain sexual impulses. Probably there'll be 10 million a day you'll choose not to act on if you don't want to get slapped around. But you'll have a sort of healthy channeled, you know, sexuality. But, you know, I don't think it's particularly healthy to flog yourself to get rid of your sexual desires. I don't think that's a healthy thing to do. So if someone comes into my office, it's not a healthy way to work with erotic desire. Someone comes into my office and you see they have an attachment to selflessness. I see this every day in my office. Someone who said, well, he's having trouble finding his way in life, finding his talent, finding his gift to life, because he thinks, oh, I don't want to be too proud, you know. And you can see he has a pride and is anathema to him. He thinks it's a venial or cardinal sin. So he can't let himself feel the pleasure of doing something that he can take pride in. That's not a healthy spirituality. That's not a good understanding of pride. There's malevolent pride, and then there's good, healthy, garden variety pride for a task well done. You see? So all of these personal qualities which are human are part of us. Taking pride, accomplishing something, relational capacities, internal emotional capacities that I was talking about, memory, orientation, all the rest of it. So what does that have to do with ego, as it's commonly known in spiritual paths? Well, what people usually refer to ego in spiritual paths, I refer to as ego attachments. It's not ego. It's not ego functions. It's ego attachments. And those are those little selves or those little parts of us that I was talking about before. They're usually very self-centered. And they're ego attachments. And what sets them apart from ego functions? And if we don't understand that, then we get into unhealthy spirituality. Well, one way we can understand is what uses are those ego functions being put to? Are they being put to the service of ego aggrandizement, of inflation and deprecation of somebody else? Well, that would be a kind of unwholesome use. If I don't just take pride in my work, but I'm talking with another therapist and I say, you know, what you did with that patient, we're having a discussion about a patient, that really sucked. What kind of training did you get? I mean, that would be very blatant, right? It's never as blatant as that. It's always much, much more subtle, but I'm using a blatant example where I am propping myself up by extension. I don't say I'm a great therapist, but I say, what kind of stupid move was that? Or I might say something very, very, very nuanced. I might say, you said that. Among therapists, that's all you have to say. You don't have to say anything else. You said what? Wow, you know. Enough said. So I would call that an ego attachment to being high and mighty, great therapist. It's very subtle. Now that person might know me and they might leave and they might still have very good feelings about me, but that night they might dream of butchering someone. You see what I'm saying? And they might come into their office of their therapist the next day. I had this funny dream of butchering this little kid. It turned out, you know, he made me into a little kid from a highfalutin person to a little kid, and then he chopped me up in little pieces and showed me who was the better therapist. You see, these things have impacts. That's what I'm trying to say. We call this karma, you know, the web of impacts, of what qualities we bring into the world. Remember I talked about, it's not a blank slate, but there's the potent, fertile void. There are no things. It's only how we connect the dots. Now what if I'm having a discussion with my therapist friend, and the way I connect the dots, the qualities I bring forth in this relationship are a subtle one-upsmanship. Let's look at the karmic reverberations of that. He starts to feel bad about himself. You know, the man kicks the dog, and the dog kicks the kid, and the kid kicks the dog. That's unhealthy spirituality. Now, it's unhealthy spirituality because I connected the dots not with him as a Buddha in his own right, worthy of love and respect and recognition, but I connected the dots with him as beneath me and me as above me, him, on a subtle level, you see. But the impacts of my response in our interaction spread, don't they? They spread. They spread into his dream life. They spread into the way he is at his work. They spread into the way he treats his kid and the way his kid treats the dog. And the way the dog bites the passerby. I mean, I'm being gross about these things. It's much, much more subtle and much, much more extensive, actually. It's very gross what I'm saying. So how we connect the dots, the spiritual qualities we bring forth in the relational field, and how that translate or doesn't translate our fundamental religious insights, that's to say, are we walking the talk, or are we just talking the talk and walking the walk in this compartment, but in that compartment, we're doing something else. You see? So healthy spirituality is based on honesty, Nick. It's based on honestly exposing and disclosing to others and to ourselves what's really going on. This is a fundamental spiritual quality, is to be honest with ourselves. There's no shame if I'm feeling inadequate vis-a-vis the Dalai Lama. Maybe I'm feeling like, oh, the Dalai Lama, he's publishing all these books. He's raking in all this money. I'll forget that his country is being occupied and he's got all these other things he's trying to do. But he's got all these books, and I haven't published one book. What's the problem with me? You see, let's say I notice that. You know, I'm in the bookstore. What do I do with it? How do I practice spiritually with that? Can I be humble enough to eat humble pie in that moment and say, look at me, big Roshi Babro, feeling enviness of the Dalai Lama after all that he went through? Well, hopefully, a healthy spirituality, a mature Buddhist practice, some psychological maturity, will allow me in that moment to be honest with myself and say, holy shit, I'm envious of the Dalai Lama. That's the truth of what's happening in this moment. And you know what they say about the truth. The truth will make you free. We're all of us nothing but human beings. So all of us experience the complete range of human emotions. The only thing is, how aware are we of that wide range? And how willing are we to really experience how we are being and feeling and what we're doing in the moment? Because we can do 1,000 prostrations and 1,000,000 purifications, and still we come back to this moment. How I am with you. How I respond to your questions. Whether I include you, recognize and respect you and value you, want to learn together with you. All the great Buddhist insights mean nothing to me unless I can meet you as a fellow pilgrim on the way. They mean nothing. To me, they mean zero. Actually, it's worse than nothing. If you find a very spiritually realized being who, I don't mean just here and there, you know, because we're all human. You know, let the one who's not sinned cast the first stone. I'm not saying that any of us is perfect. But it's worse to be a spiritually realized person and to treat other people, places, things, animals, minerals, and vegetables shabbily than if you never had the realization in the first place. On the hierarchy of, not exactly sins, but unwholesome behavior, that's a bad one. Because you've had the experience of intimacy and connection and the divinity of the person sitting in front of you. So that psychotherapy, personal relationships, is the proving ground. It's the crucible in which we refine our realization. Thank God for my kid, you know, pushing my buttons. How else could I refine my realization? Could I bring it forth? If everybody just goes, yasm, yasm, Roshi Babro, I will never learn. Actually, not enough people do that. I think more people should do that, but no. I like a little balance. But if that's all I got, I mean, you know, I become a sycophant, and everyone around me are sycophants. So thank God. That's why Pema Chodron's making a mint on all these books. What is she saying? She's saying one thing over and over again. Bless her soul. Teachers just really say one thing over and over. She says, hang out where you're most uncomfortable. You'll be all right. Right? When Things Fall Apart. That's the title of her first book. People get one note and they keep playing that note over and over again because people don't get it. She's brilliant. And people keep buying her books because they keep bumping up against discomfort and pain. And they don't know how to work with it in a spiritual way. They don't see that fundamental insight that I was saying before, that pain, just like the pleasure and just like it all, is the manifestation of the divine. We don't see it because we're caught up in wanting pleasure and pushing away pain. But the realized person doesn't make pain into pleasure. They don't pretend that pleasure is pain and pain is pleasure. They see things very clearly. Pain is pain, pleasure is pleasure. Someone's a jerk and the other guy's a good person. They see that from the get-go, before, you know, at the crack of a whip. They don't need to see how the horse runs. The realized person knows this. You know, the old worthies in Zen, you walk into the room, you walk down the hall, and they know the quality of your mind. But they're not attached to how you treat them. You step on them, you shit on them, you like them, you love them, you laud them. Water off a duck's back. Quality of non-attachment is the spiritual quality, you see, because that allows you to be in the moment and to bear witness to the sanctity of each moment. It's not that you don't enjoy a wonderful moment with a beautiful, intelligent person. You love it. It's not that you don't hate a moment where someone's dumping all their stuff on you without any reason, treating you like shit. I mean, even a realized person, forgive me, they don't like that. But they're not attached to not liking that. You see what I'm saying? That's the freedom. That's the key to liberation. Do you think a realized person likes the state of this world? Well, no realized person worth their salt is going to like the state of the world. But they do what they can. They do what they can because they see that in that moment of doing something, there's the whole universe. The whole universe is right there. And the realized person is not attached to results, doesn't do things for the fruits, just does things because they're right, does things because they're good, does things because in her heart of hearts, she knows that that's right. And she knows that if she does the right thing, she will, in Hippocrates' words, do no harm. At least she'll do no harm. Ahimsa, right? No non-harming. That's the name of this organization. It's the pivotal principle of all the great world's religions, Buddhism too, non-harming. But for non-harming, we need honesty. We need to be honest with ourselves. If we don't like somebody, we got to be honest with that. We got to be honest. Why don't I like this person? What is that? What are they sponsoring me? What gets created between us? I can't pretend I like that person. I can act cordially and humanely with them while I'm trying to understand what I don't like. So I got to be really honest. You see. So honesty, in the wake of honesty, see, honesty is a precondition for prajna. In Buddhism, we have three things. Things come in threes. Prajna, dhyana, and sila. If you know this, you know all of Buddhism. Sila is ethics. It's not just the code of ethics, but ethical conduct, right conduct. Being good, being straight, being kind, being upright. It's not a matter of being perfect. Dhyana is practice or meditation. right practice, being attentive, being awake, being honest. You see how some of these qualities intermingle? If you're honest, you're also practicing Shila, right? If you're honest and awake to what's going on in the moment, you're knocking off two birds with one stone. You're being ethical and you're doing your practice. See? These things inter-are. And then you have the third thing, which is insight or wisdom that comes from repeated insight. Prajna, I love that word. Prajna, dhyana. The word Zen comes from dhyana. It's a transliteration of the Sanskrit. Zen means practice or attentiveness, meditation. And Shila, S-I-L-A, is ethics. So the realized person knows that wisdom begets ethical conduct. If you say you're a wise person and you're acting unwise, your wisdom ain't worth anything. If you're practicing diligently and you're aware, as let's say the Theravadan Buddhists, the Vipassana people, if you're really practicing Vipassana, not just California Vipassana, but I love a lot of people in California, but if you're really, you're aware of every moment, the fine points of every moment. Talk about deconstructing. The self is just a series of moments. You see it, how we construct the self moment to moment. Okay. If you're practicing like that with an amazing focus and you never see into who you are, you never develop insight, you never use that practice to see into the essential sacredness of all beings, the connection between all beings, then your practice will have been for naught. You're a great practitioner, but you don't see into the true nature of things. Or if you practice all the ethical guidelines, what are you? You're a good guy. Maybe a little bit of a goody two-shoes. Now, you do everything right. You're a good boy, a good girl. But if you don't have a practice that helps you see into the true nature of things and develop wisdom, your ethics become a little bit of a burden, aren't they? I mean, if you're just practicing all these austerities, like the Buddha did, all these austerities, whipping the body, punishing the body, doing all the bows, doing all the purification, you're good, but you know what's really happening? You know why you're not having any breakthrough? Because inside you're saying, when is God going to reward me? That's what's really happening. But you can't see that because you don't have enough practice. You don't have enough concentration to see into all of your ethical goodness. Because if you could see into that, you'd have a little bit of insight, a little bit of prajna, right? So you see how those three work? The insight, the wisdom, the meditation practice and attentiveness, and the goodness. The one who sees into the nature of things, at the heart of things, has wisdom from practice, and naturally, in my vision and in any Buddhist teacher's vision, will act skillfully and kindly. That action, right action, ethical action, flows from insight. Never perfectly, but in a realized person, you'll find all three of these things well developed, talking to one another, not in their own little compartments. And if you only see one of them, stay away. Or if you see two, even better. But you want to see three working together. Understanding, practice, and living relational action. When they're working together, you got a realized person. And that realized person doesn't need anyone to tell her that she's doing good. She's not doing good to be a good boy. She's doing good because good is wise. Because good reflects the nature of the universe. Okay? What I love about Zen, and I'd love to have more dialogue, we have 5 more minutes. What I love about Zen is each of the religions has its kind of archetypal ideal. And the ideal of the Zen teacher is that you would never know her or him unless you came to their meditation hall. You'd never know them in everyday life. They're completely ordinary. That's to say, they've worn off their rough edges to so much that they just completely fit in life. Maybe if you sat down with them and had dinner, you know, you might notice some nice qualities. You feel kind of nice, you feel enlivened, you have a good discussion, you know. But there's nothing really special. In Zen, we say there's the stink of Zen. And you usually find someone about 10, 15 years into practice. I know from personal experience. They sort of have the stink of Zen. Aren't I special in my ordinariness? You see? There's still something sticking. They're still attached to some way of being or some aesthetic. You'll see it in how they walk or how they... But the really realized Zen person mingles with the crowd. Do you know the 10 ox herding pictures? Have any of you seen the 10 ox herding pictures? Sort of a trajectory of Zen practice. And in the last picture, it shows this big, fat, old Buddha walking into the market, carrying a little sack on his back. And that sack represents all of the sort of goodies that he can give to the little kids and share with everybody. But the real Zen practitioner, whether she or he's a teacher or Roshi, it doesn't matter. The real Zen practitioner, you can't tell. They just benefit the world just by the ordinary things they do in their own little corner of the world. They have no claim to fame, but wherever they go, flowers blossom. So that kind of anonymity has always been very precious to me. And I've noticed it in some of my teachers, and I cherish it. But it's a hard-fought quality. And of course, if you scratch a little bit, you find something there. You maybe find more and more and more there, depending on how you make use of that person. And especially if you want to study Zen with them, then you get to know a lot about them. This quality of ordinariness without any stink attached to it reflects the deep understanding that in every moment we're realizing our true nature with one another. And we can enjoy that and share that in all of the moments of our lives. So I've said way too much. I like to chatter a lot, but if there are remaining question or two or comment, Ruth?
I thought I'd like to hear you say a little about suffering in Zen. Suffering as seen by Zen, and then
suffering,
where suffering
as seen through the lens of Zen.
Yes, and then where. Okay, thank you. And where and how does the Buddhist find joy?
Yeah.
Are we talking about a world of suffering that we must endure, or are there other rewards?
Yeah. Well, a common misunderstanding about Zen and about the first noble truth of Zen. You heard about the four noble truths? You got these four noble truths. The first noble truth is so often, I think, and I'm not a scholar, so I think it's really mistranslated, but certainly I don't like the translation that says life is suffering. I just think it's incorrect. And I've been told by many Buddhist scholars, you know, that it is incorrect. That what the Buddha said, bless his soul, you know, we don't even know really if he existed as he said to exist. A lot is the legend. But the teaching as I understand it is life is that there is suffering, not life is suffering. So let's get things straight right out of the gates. There is suffering is a lot different then life is suffering. There is suffering. Why is there suffering? We just have a few more minutes, so I'll go on, and anyone who wants to leave, just leave. But I'll just respond to the question. Take me a little while. The second noble truth is what evokes suffering, what causes suffering. The traditional translation is desire. I don't agree with that. The desire causes suffering. I think desire is an energy which is very, very important. And if any of you want to read a good book on desire, Mark Epstein's new book called Open to Desire is a very good book. I don't agree with everything in it. I take issue with a lot in it, but as a book, as a message, I think it's very good. He's reclaiming desire and the energy behind desire, putting it to spiritual purposes. The way that I see what the Buddha said, and this is Bobro speaking, this isn't Zen speaking, is that suffering arises because of aversion and avoidance, because of aversion and attachment. Ego attachments we're talking about, or aversion. Sometimes they bring three. It's the three horsemen instead of the two. The three poisons, variously translated as greed, hatred, and either delusion or ignorance. Those factors are the factors of suffering, not desire, and certainly not sexual desire. I don't think sexual desire causes suffering. How we use sexual desire, whether we use it exploitatively, deceptively, self-aggrandizingly, that causes a great deal of suffering. But intrinsically, there's nothing corrosive about sexual desire. You may choose to be celibate because that's your calling. I have great friends who are monastic, celibate monastics. It may not be your calling. It's not everybody's calling. I think, you know, to each their own. But I disagree with the view that desire is a cause of suffering. So attachment and aversion and being stuck in the ping pong game of attachment and aversion cause suffering. That's a very profound truth, because the Buddha, as I read him, was not saying that suffering is breaking your leg. That's not primarily the kind of suffering the Buddha was talking about. Being born was not a lot of fun. I mean, I've never re-experienced my birth, but I saw my son being born, and, you know, it wasn't a lot of fun for him. It was a lot of fun for me. It was not a lot of fun for my wife. But she was very glad after he was born, and so were we. So there are certain kinds of, we might say, pain that goes with the territory. It just goes with being human. You know, if your parent lives till 90 and she dies, you suffer, but that's, you know, it comes with the territory. I don't mean to belittle it, but there's certain average expectable life pain. Suffering, in the Buddhist view, is voluntary. That's to say, anguish is a lot of our own making. Again, how we connect the dots of life. If I'm always connecting the dots of life is sticking it to me, and I feel I've got to turn around and stick it back to life and get mine before life gets its, then I'm going to have a very unhappy life, aren't I? And every time something bad happens to me, I say, see, this is just the way it is. I'm a piece of crap, and life is just confirming that, and I better get mine while I can and where I can. Now, many of us respond to life in this way. That's our outlook. So the Buddha taught that it's all in how we respond to life. And the attentiveness we summon up to be able to be aware, not just of what's happening to us, but how we're responding to what's happening to us, to the whole gestalt. If we can become aware of how we're responding to life, then we can create good karma. Good karma is not about just doing 1,000 bows and umpteen prostrations. Good karma is about being awake to what intentions and what motivations and what emotional qualities we're bringing to bear in our relational lives, what seeds we're planting, what we're putting out, as the lingo goes. And what we're putting out, we're unaware of 9/10 of the time. So Buddhist practice is becoming aware of how we're responding and what we're putting out in every moment of living, because we're creating our karma and karma for other people by our response. So the third noble truth is there is a way to end suffering and anguish, and the way is through the Noble Eightfold Path, which I've only talked about three of them, sort of right wisdom, right attentiveness, and right ethics and right conduct. There are eight of them, right speech and all kinds of things, which we don't have time to go into. But the third noble truth is that there is a way to extricate ourselves from suffering, and it is through ahimsa. I'm proclaiming this to the mountains on wide. This is the great teaching. If you can't do good, at least don't do any harm. And preferably do good. But doing good comes from practice, right? Dhyana comes from attentiveness. From dhyana comes wisdom. Wisdom is in each moment. Wisdom is not just a great enlightenment experience. Wisdom is seeing through attention what is going on here. That's the question of Buddhism. What is going on here in this moment, in that moment, in the world moment? Buddhism is very simple. What is going on here? What is so? That's all Buddhism is, in a nutshell. If we see what's going on here deeply in our own hearts, what intentions we have, what motivations we have, what understandings are fueling our activities, they may be very narrow understandings. If we can see all of that, and that takes a lot, then our conduct will not make more suffering. It may not change everything about the world in any external, according to any external standards, but it will not breed any more unwholesome karma. I guarantee you this. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So not making more suffering is pretty good. That's pretty good. And everybody can do this. You don't have to be a realized being. You don't have to be a Roshi. You don't have to be a Rinpoche. You don't have to be anybody. You just be who you are, honest, in the moment, aware, committed to not making any more suffering. And then you will naturally develop these capacities of practice, attentiveness, awareness, and you will naturally see what's going on. So you'll be developing wisdom. And that wisdom, of course, will go deeper and deeper and deeper because there are lots and lots of levels to what's happening. Right? We talked a little bit about that. You can see right into the nature of the universe just through one interaction. And then, if you apply it and are open to the level of the emotional field, then you can put all of that into practice and see, what unconscious obstructions you may have and unconscious fetters you may have. And then the light can really shine. And then not only are you not making any more suffering, but you're actually becoming a beacon. See, Mary Oliver translates the Buddha's last words very beautifully. Usually they're translated, "Be a light unto yourself." And you know how she translates it? "Make of yourselves a lamp." Isn't that a beautiful translation? Make of yourself a lamp. You see how different that is from "be a light unto yourself"? Be a light unto yourself means, don't depend on anybody else. Well, that's true up to a point. But all of us depend on one another, don't we? We depend on the air we breathe. We're completely dependent. So make of ourselves a lamp so that what we're spreading and what we're sharing and how we're responding to the pain of life, to the first noble truth, there is suffering, doesn't make more of it, and even begins to dispel it. That's the Buddhist path to suffering.
Thank you.
Place we can stop? Okay. Would people like to just maybe for 60 seconds do a little chant? You'd be interested in doing a little chant? This is a Korean chant I learned from a Korean Zen teacher. It's very melodic and very beautiful. You can do it for hours. You can do it at, we won't do it for hours. We'll do it for a minute or two. But you can do it on people's deathbeds or when someone's being born. You can do it at all times. It's the evocation of Kuan Yin, the evocation of the Bodhisattva of mercy, compassion. Often pictured with 1,000 arms, one arm for each situation, for each specific iteration of suffering, responding in accord with the situation, with what that person, that situation needs, wisely and compassionately. So we evoke Kuan Yin, and we evoke the power of compassion in ourselves as we chant. So it just is. Kwan Zeum is Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion in Korean. Kwan Zeum. Bosal means praise be to Kuan Yin, to Kwan Zeum. Basically, just see it as an invocation. Okay?
Kwan Zeum Bosal, 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 Kwan Zeum Bosa, 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 Kwan Zeum Bosa.
Thank you all very much.
Just want to make a short announcement, and that's we have a donation box in the back of the room. Should anybody feel inspired to make a contribution to AHIMSA, I want to thank you all for being here tonight. I was going to ask Joe to answer a few questions. I have a cup of water here. I'd like his short answer rather than his long one.
What's the question?
It doesn't matter.
Question.
Okay, from a divine mean old SOB, yeah. How do you teach compassion?
Come over here. Come closer so you can hear my answer.
Thank you, Joe. And also, if you have.
Part to the answer.
Yes.
Have a sip.
Thank you. Also, if you haven't already signed your name, if you want to be on our mailing list, there's a little card over there. Appreciate if everybody puts their name down so we can continue to send you information about these different events. Nick, did you have something you wanted to say?
I was going to offer Snezhna, who came back from Ukiah and represents as the director of the IWR, the Institute for World Religions, to invite you for next month's program.
Well, I guess I have to say, since Nick so kindly gave me this mic, And I do wish to thank you. It was a wonderfully enlightening evening. And I thank you on behalf of the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery and the Institute for World Religions. It's too bad that our resident monk wasn't here to sing or to chant the Guanyin Pusa along, but that's fine. I think it was a wonderful evening. And next month we will have another of these talks. I don't have the program in front of me, and as you know, I just came from Ukiah, so I'm kind of unaware of what's really going on. So next program will be February 21st. Here again at 7:30, and the speaker would be a good friend of mine, Seyda Nahid Anga, who is a lady from Iran, practicing Sufi, and she will tell us about the living spirit of surrender in Sufism and in Islam. So I urge you all to come, and we will hopefully have another evening as successful as this one. Thank you for coming.
I'd like to also invite anyone who's interested in learning more about meditation, Zen meditation, or practicing with Deep Stream Zendo to check out our website, deepstreams.org. Our monthly meditations happen in San Francisco the last Sunday of the month from 10 to 4. And if you're interested, you can either let me know or just email us through the contact link on the website or give us a call. All that information is at deepstreams.org. So this Sunday we'll be having a sitting from 10 to 4. Anyone is welcome to join us in San Francisco. I'd like to thank the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery and to thank you so much for your good questions and for helping us engage some dialogue. Thank you.